organizations should be able to allow developers to build on their environments with security already built in without them having to worry about that.
This is KBCast. As a primary target for ransomware campaigns,
is security and testing and performance and scalability.
Risk and compliance.
We can actually automate that.
Take that data and use it.
Joining me today is Fernando Certo, Chief Technologist and Evangelist, APJC from Cloudflare. And today we're discussing AI overriding the current threat. So Fernando, thanks for joining and welcome.
Thanks for having me, Carissa.
Okay, so I want to start with, now I watched this interview, Mo Gaudat, who was the former Chief Business Officer for Google X. Now, he's been on multiple media interviews recently, and he's saying that AI poses a larger threat than global warming. Now, that's a full-blown statement, so I want to start with your thoughts on that.
Look, I've seen multiple of his interviews, and including a two-hour-long interview with on the CEO Diaries, I think. He does have some interesting points, right? But I think the problem that he raises is more sort of how fast things are moving versus how much damage have we done from a climate change perspective, right? And sort of getting into the, well, what is it 20 years from now if we don't make any changes from, reducing carbon footprint and stuff like that? Versus what are the impact of, in the same period of time from an AI development perspective, right? So, everything is interconnected today. People are giving more and more control to AI-powered devices. And yeah, so I agree that there's certainly a risk. I don't think we are at a point of no return yet. In his role, I think, he's advising people to be a little bit more careful, and that comes with a level of, fear, I guess. But, there's obviously, the positives that he mentions about AI as well, right? And the amount of development, if it's done the right way, it's suddenly, there's a lot of things that are being done, to make our lives easier, right?
Yeah, so careful I get, but I feel sometimes, and maybe Mo is a classic example of this, that there's this real FUD about it. That's the part that I'm mindful of, because I try not to approach AI with the whole doom and gloom approach. And, there's some pretty radical terms that were thrown around in the interview. And you got to think, people who are not in technology or cybersecurity, what do they think? And is it setting maybe the wrong precedent for people on how they look at AI?
This is the biggest problem, right? Because if you look into, all the, a couple of weeks ago when I can't remember what was an article around WarmGPT, and everyone was like, oh, there you go. So now hackers can just go into that and use exactly the same way as ChatGPT, and they're going to write malware, and they're going to, and in the end, all the tool does is help people or help, attackers with business email compromise campaigns, right? Which ChatGPT can already do, right? It's just that it removes the sort of the guidelines and some of the guardrails that ChatGPT has around that. But it does nothing more than, giving you better grammar, better, understanding of, the English language or other languages and being able to craft, more intelligent emails. I've seen, plenty of, YouTube videos of people saying, oh, look at that, you can write malware now with ChatGPT. And there's, really bad malware. What will continue to happen, that, bad malware is easy to be detected. And, AI, yes, will help that, but is that really a threat? Because of the unknown of AI and a lot of people not having the technical understanding of how it works, I think it ends up generating a lot of chatter and, a lot of fear. And in reality, that we already have a lot of tools out there on our arsenal that will counter a lot of these, very basic types of attacks that you can generate with the tools that are available today, right?
So, okay, a couple of things in there that I want to just dig into a little bit more. Do you think as well, because it is uncharted water for AI, that that's where people are worried and they're scared about it? I'll give you an example. So when the internet came around, there was probably same type of chatter. I think there was even some articles saying like, oh, the internet won't go anywhere or something along those lines. But because the internet didn't really exist in the same format while it is today, there's that same sort of fear, uncertainty, and doubt because people don't know what they don't know. There's no data points. We are moving into these waters that are unknown. So do you think that scared, worrisome approach is derived from what we don't know?
100%. What people don't realize is that the tools that we have available today, right, from an AI perspective, they are helping people accelerate whatever they're doing, right? And that can be for malicious purposes or just, rewriting an email in a better way, right? the problem that people don't understand that, you know, because you can really quickly craft a malicious email, that doesn't mean that that email is not going to get picked up by any sort of email security tool out there.
Look, I know you don't have a crystal ball, you don't have all the answers, I get that. It's more just an opinion piece. Like, what would be your guess as to why there are still, like, so many people worried about AI, like, you know, Mo and friends out there saying this type of stuff, which then does engender perhaps maybe the wrong approach towards artificial intelligence for the general public? I'm just curious as to know, like, where is still this, like, coming from? Like, is it helpful, though? Because I don't think it is, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
I actually disagree. I think it is helpful, right? So I think the one of the things that, you know, a lot of organizations started to worry about now is, you know, what's the threat of data leaking from just using ChatGPT? It's a little bit exaggerated. I'll agree with you on that. But it's shining the light into a problem that not a lot of people understand. It forces people to go and educate themselves so that they have a better understanding of what the risk actually is, right? The risk is, you know, governments not being careful with how they implement certain types of technologies, right? And governments will use, you know, several different, you know, cybersecurity vendors, IT vendors, and there's a risk of some of these tools being integrated into systems that are critical to, you know, controlling, I don't know, nuclear weapons, right? And that's the one of the things that I've heard in some of the interviews, that's where the real risk is. An AI or a model making decisions based on what the sample of data is, right? And if you look into the amount of conflicts that we had throughout history, do humans hate each other, right? So is it getting to a point where, you know, AI was just like, okay, well, humans are bad and, you know, make a decision but based on that. But so that there is that risk, but this is sort of so far-fetched that, you know, I think we, at the same time that we're building this capability, we're also building a lot of controls around it and putting the right guardrails in place to not allow that to happen.
So you mentioned before that people should go out and educate themselves. That I agree with. But then you also mentioned that some of these theories or opinions are far-fetched. So if someone who doesn't know about AI, they go and listen to people like Mo or whoever's out there, whoever they want to listen to is fine. But then they're giving far-fetched opinions. So is that solving the overall problem then? Or is it that, yes, they're trying to educate themselves, but are they fishing from the wrong pond?
I'll give an example of, you know, my family, for example, right? Like my dad's probably the most technically savvy out of them all. I was in Brazil a couple of weeks ago and dad was scared of, you know, using ChatGPT. My brother, on the other hand, uses it for everything. And some of his colleagues, and my brother at least has got a little bit of an understanding of not put, you know, confidential information in there and just sort of ask for guidelines around government regulation and things like that. But he knows a lot of people who will just upload full contracts of, you know, full of confidential information to ChatGPT just to get, you know, a couple of clauses rewritten. The fact that there's so much FUD around AI is sparking these conversations, right? And people are sort of debating that, you know, in the barbecues with friends. And there's always going to be someone who's like, no, that's not how it happens. And sort of, you know, that forces people to understand a little bit more what the threat actually is. And, you know, to be able to have a more intelligent conversation, right? And as I said, as long as we're shining the light into the problem and more people are talking about it, I think it will be good for everyone just because of it's not going to get, and no one's going to get blindsided by, you know, oh, wow, I didn't know that this existed, right?
So do you think people were blindsided by ChatGPT?
I don't think anyone was expecting that something like that would ever exist, something that was open to the public like that, right? So we never had something, you know, as powerful as that, right? Yes, we had, you know, Google search and Bing and, you know, Alta Vista. And, you know, throughout the years, we had, you know, several iterations of that. But you needed to be searching for things that had the right terms. And based on, you know, techniques around search engine optimization, you will find, you know, the right or wrong results. We never really had something that could, you know, rewrite a whole paragraph of an email using sentiment, for example, right? And say, oh, you know, I want to sound a little bit more upbeat on this particular paragraph, and it will just rewrite for you, right? I've seen some of the, you know, the examples of people using ChatGPT in the early days. People just sat in front of that, and they didn't understand that it was a natural language, just like you speak to anyone else on any chat application, right? On any messaging application.
So do people need to be worried about AI at the end of the day? Yes or no?
I think the general population, no. people in, you know, leadership roles in government, yes. For the average user, look, there's a lot of good that comes out of it. The biggest problem that we have, I think, from a privacy and security perspective is the fact that social engineering has always been part of the arsenal of a good attacker. And this is what worries me the most. So social engineering from a business email compromise perspective, or someone listening to, you know, this interview and getting my voice or yours and being able to do voice authentication against, you know, particular systems, calling your parents and pretending to be you with, hey, I had an accident, I lost my phone or whatever. And I think this is the bit that people are not very aware of from a general population perspective. And this is where the biggest risk for society is. But the actual, you know, AI as technology, I don't think it's a risk. I think there's a lot of benefits, and we're going to have to learn how to mitigate a lot of these types of vectors, right? Like we have in cybersecurity for decades, right?
So do you think people really know how to deal with that? Because, I mean, I've spoken to people at length on this show, like very senior people in very big organizations, and they're like, look, there's no handbook. We're still trying to work it out. So, and the way in which technology is growing now is the velocity is tenfold to what it used to be even a couple of years ago. So how are we going to manage all this? Because, I mean, like at the end of the day, like we're still trying to do basic security here, and then we're adding on all this other complexity with AI and talking about even on the voice side of it, and that, you know, my voice 200 plus hours is out there. So you are right and you make a great point. But where do we sort of go from here?
The tools are being built, right, to mitigate against those. So, whenever people talk about AI fighting AI, I think, you know, like from a business email compromise perspective, for example, right, like we already have tools in place to detect, you know, AI generated emails. We already have tools in place that detect sentimental messages, and knowing that, you know, Fernando and Carissa have never really emailed each other, or if they have, they never really talked about this particular subject before. So these tools already exist, right? Now the voice part of it, I think it's something that we haven't really built enough capability to mitigate that. But the rest of it, from a generative AI perspective, we already have. Probably the images, I think that will be an interesting one. You know, AI generated images. I've seen some, you know, crazy examples of some pretty realistic photos, right? So these are sort of, you know, the misinformation risk is higher than ever before, right? And I think this is something that we need to learn how to curate content a little bit better, being able to identify and detect, you know, particular signatures of that will indicate that particular content was generated using AI tools. And, you know, as everything is, as I said before, right, with cybersecurity, we're always learning. It's always there's a new piece of tech that was never really used for malicious purposes before. One day it starts to get used for malicious purposes, and we've got to learn how to mitigate that.
Doesn't that become exhausting after a while? Because you are right. As soon as we've somewhat half solved a problem, the next problem's out, and another one, another one. Like, aren't people just fatigued, though?
The old techniques, we've got them pat down, and it's something that historically we have built tools that will eventually detect that, right? And there's going to be a lot of AI built into that as well that we'll have integrated into, you know, SIEM systems, you know, looking into, you know, all sorts of things from, you know, IP addresses to DNS records to signatures, fingerprinting of devices, and all of that will go into making decisions of what's malicious or not, right? And we've been doing that for years. It's just that there's a new vector that, you know, we haven't really had to deal with before.
Do you think we are dealing with it, though?
Yes. Yes. I think from a voice perspective, it hasn't been a risk to large organizations in a cybersecurity team in a large enterprise. And that's why we haven't really seen tools coming up to mitigate that. But, you know, we're suddenly building a lot of capability around all other vectors that are sort of social engineering using AI and so on, right? Around emails, collaboration tools, messaging, and so on.
That is a good point. And, you know, what other people are talking about, again, even on the show, is cyber criminals are attacking us with AI and we're defending with AI. Would you agree with that statement?
I don't like to say that attackers are attacking us with AI, right? Because I think AI is just a little bit of a tool that, you know, we're not seeing attacks being generated automatically, you know, like in large scale with, someone just going to a prompt, like a, you know, ChatGPT like and say, attack KBI media. We're not doing that. So we're not seeing that. But, you know, people sort of rewriting code or, you know, using the AI tools to generate tools that will be used eventually for malicious purposes. Yes, we are seeing that, right? And on the Defenders toolkit, we have a lot of AI powered already tools. Like for example, Cloudflare's web application firewall has AI built in, right? And we're trying to reduce the time to mitigate for whenever we see a new vector, like Log4j, for example, just over a year ago. How quickly can we detect that we haven't ever seen that particular payload before? How quickly can we make a decision that is suspicious or malicious and start blocking that traffic? So, and we're reducing that significantly using scoring-based systems that are using ML and AI as a WAF. We use the same type of techniques on emails. We use the same type of techniques on malicious host names, you know, using DNS as a security tool. So there's a lot of on the Defenders toolkit as well that is already using AI, right? So if you think of AI versus AI, that's already sort of happening, right? But it's not like robots without any assistance from humans are deciding who to attack, what vectors to exploit, and then on the Defender side, they're just like, oh, hang on, there's something new here that I haven't seen, so I need to protect these particular assets, and you'll just do it in a really creative way, right? I don't think we're there. I think we are quite far away from that. But the research and reconnaissance part of an attack, there's certainly a lot of AI tools that will be helping attackers to succeed on that.
Yeah, so that's the operative word, tools. So let me rephrase. So basically, let's start with, I'll give you an example. So if we're leveraging AI tools to, attack KBI Media or whatever, it's going to reduce the time potentially because you're using a tool to assist with that. So just say something normally takes 10 hours, but using some AI tool, it's only taking 4. That's then going to increase the velocity. Would you agree with that?
Correct. I do agree with that, yes.
And so would that be where people, as in general people in the, in the world or people in organizations or people not with a security background, is that what they would then think about, that it's a tool? Do you think that's where the disconnect comes from? Like, it's not just starting on its own in the morning and saying, I'm just going to attack KBI Media as soon as I wake up. Like, there's none of that that's happening. But again, it's the tool that's part of that arsenal belt.
Spot on. Yes.
So how do we correct and re-educate people that it is a tool and it doesn't just spin up on its own and start doing its own thing as what maybe people think it's doing? How do we sort of change the narrative for that?
The evolution of tools on both sides will continue to move really rapidly, right? The biggest problem that we have is that the basics are still not being done. How do organizations get breached, right? There's usually a vulnerability or a vulnerable piece of software or hardware that gets exploited. Someone manages to, breach that and get root access into that particular device. From then on, they move laterally, they find the crown jewels, and they start to exfiltrate data. So all of these phases of an attack, there will be some tools that will help the attacker accelerate that, but it's not going to do it on its own, right? Because every environment will be different. It's not going to have the ability to, you're not going to have the hacker.ai toolkit that you just deploy once and, you'll find every possible exploit and the ability to exploit, every possible vulnerability and the ability to exploit them. The problem with the velocity and the ability to accelerate these types of attacks, as you mentioned, the only way to combat that is us being faster in patching vulnerable devices, vulnerable systems. CISA sends out an email with all the new known exploited vulnerabilities, right? So these are vulnerabilities that have been disclosed, so CVEs that have been disclosed, and when they start seeing actual exploitation of those. And there was a Citrix vulnerability that had a CVSS score of 9.8 that was just added overnight for us into that database. The Fortinet vulnerability from June, July, I think, there was an article on Leaping Computer in early July saying that there was about 300,000 vulnerable Fortinet devices running the vulnerable version of FortiOS still out in the wild. I did a piece of research 2 years ago around a Citrix vulnerability as well, that 5 months after the patch had already been released by Citrix, there were still 144 organizations in Australia that hadn't patched them. This is the problem that, AI will help the attackers to accelerate the attacks. And how do we combat that? We're just going to do better, right? We've got to use better you know, asset and vulnerability management tools, start exposing applications and environments on the internet, try and have a good grasp of our cloud environments. What are we doing to make sure that, you know, we're not putting vulnerable code there, right? So I think this is where we need to learn. And certainly, you know, there's vulnerability management tools out there. There's asset management tools out there that are using AI to sort of help organizations understand how to move faster.
Yes, to help, but it doesn't always do 100%. And do you think that people just think that, oh, well, you know, you've got AI doing all these things, like, okay, let's look at a vulnerability tool, for example. Doesn't mean you can just sort of put your feet up and not worry about it. Like, it's going to help and it's probably going to do a bit better, but it doesn't mean it's going to solve world hunger.
That's been the nature of the game, right? Like, we never really put our feet up, right? And my 20-something years in cybersecurity, never for once, you know, had the ability to rest and say, all right, we're good for a few weeks, right? Because yeah, we just don't know what's around the corner, right?
No. And from my understanding that, you know, we're talking about, you know, AI and the form it is today and people worried about it, et cetera. But one of the things that worries you is the threats that are actually on our doorstep. And you mentioned before about like patch management. Yes, and I've spoken about the patch management literally at length about this. There's all these books of theories of 20 years on how to do patch management, right? Patch Tuesday, whatever that whole thing used to be. But we still can't get it right. So we're talking about very basic things, as everyone keeps saying, oh, it's about the basics, but we still can't, and I've spoken about this so many hours about it, but we can't even do that. And then we're worried about these other like threats that are out there, but we can't do basic stuff for the last 20 years. So how do we compute all of this if we can't do basic rudimentary things like patch management?
I totally agree with you. And you know, that there's been the most difficult conversation with customers is the fact that, you know, when you're on a, you know, obviously, you know, I work for Cloudflare, so I work for a vendor. When you're there, they have the impression that you're trying to sell them something, right, rather than provide. But the problem is that if you look into government, for example, right, the time it takes for them to go through a procurement process, right, to select the right tool for asset and vulnerability management, for example, they're going to go through that process for, you know, 12, 18 months. By the time they make a decision, there's either something better in the market or their environment has changed so much because of cloud or SaaS or whatever that, you know, that tool is not as relevant as it should have been 12, 18 months before, right? So I think it's just that people need to start treating cybersecurity as micro projects to solve problems rather than, you know, big, you know, budgetary and procurement exercises.
So how do we start treating it as micro projects? So how do people start? I do hear what you're saying. I understand even in large corporate environments, it's still, you know, 18 months, 24 month deal cycle and things have changed in 2 years. How do people adjust that mindset? Because it's very easy for us to talk about it in theory and it's easier, but you've got these big companies that are around hundreds of years or whatever it may be, and it's hard to change that mindset because if we don't, we're going to fall into a lot of the problems that we've already discussed today on this interview. So what would be your thoughts?
Cybersecurity has been sort of, you know, adjacent or attached to IT procurement processes, right? Which is typically we need to, you know, do some sort of transformational project. Well, how many do you need? How many of what size, right? Which it was the way they used to buy servers, routers, laptops, you know, desktops, whatever, right? And I think if we start to look into what are the types of users that we have in the organization, what do they need to do work? What are the tools that they need access to do their jobs effectively? Let's look into, you know, giving a better way of giving that access to them. So something that doesn't really rely on, you know, network connectivity, you know, VPNs or being inside the environment or anything like that, but looking into the role of that particular user. And how can we make the secure access into those tools a little bit better for the organization, right? Or a little bit more secure? And as soon as you start doing that, you get like a, you know, how many people in procurement, for example? I don't know, 20, 30, 100 people. All right, let's solve the problem for 100 people, right? That every time you're solving a problem in pockets like that, you're better off than you were yesterday. And a lot of the CISOs that I'm friends with, that I talk to, if you look into their risk register, there's the big ticket items, and then there's a ton of little things that they need to fix. The problem is that procurement has always been the, you know, all right, well, how many of these problems do you want to fix this year? I don't know, 100 of them. Okay, well, I need, you know, $10 million or whatever, right? And sometimes they won't get the budget to solve all the problems, and they got to look into, well, let's go after the big ones. And in reality, we should, you know, split the big ones into multiple smaller ones and try and, you know, solve them throughout the year and look into how many things can we cross off the risk register to make the organization or to give the organization a better cybersecurity posture, right?
I understand that. Wouldn't that depend on who is in charge running the department? So, for example, I've spoken to 200 plus people now just on this show alone. When I speak to every single guest, I'm like, and it could be something so specialized, I'm like, oh, that's so important. But then how do you start to prioritize those things? Because everything that you're talking about is important, but then the next person will roll up. What they talk about is really important. Everyone's going to be fighting for this is more important than the next guy. So how does someone in an organization start to prioritize that? Because what you're saying makes sense, but then you know the next 10 people may have really good arguments as well that equally say what they're saying is more important, it should be prioritized. How do you manage that?
Based on risk, and probably the one of the problems that we have is that a lot of organizations still don't understand what the exposure is for that particular risk item. What is the you know, from brand damage to, you know, data loss to intellectual property loss, what does that equate to drive urgency to fix that particular issue, right? If you look into the majority of attack surface exposures that Unit 42 worked on, more than 20% of them are still brute forcing credentials on, you know, exposed RDP servers or remote desktop servers. So all the, you know, there's a lot of stuff like that that still happens in organizations because they're just trying to plug a gap, right? But no one really understands what the risk is to the organization if that particular server gets breached. This is a problem with the industry, right? Because we're still treating everything as IT, as, you know, interconnected systems rather than, you know, if someone gets access to that particular data set, what is the damage to the organization, right?
What do you mean they don't understand? What is it specifically they don't understand, though?
The dollar value on what that exposure can do to the organization.
Why not?
I think there's not a lot of people who understand how to put a dollar value against, you know, if someone breaches a CRM, for example, what is the, you know, what is the damage to the organization?
But there's kind of a hard one to answer though. Wouldn't you agree?
100%, I agree.
Yeah. So how do you approach it though? Because they're not going to know what's in Fernando's head from a technical point of view. So you may know technically. How do you then transfer them to a dollar figure? CFO people probably have no clue.
CFO needs to get involved from a loss perspective, right? Like, you know, what is from a brand damage perspective? They need to run some, you know, tabletop exercises on that. You know, depending on the types of data sets that they have within the organization, you know, what's on a particular database? What type of data is there? Is that PII? Is that, you know, confidential information just to the organization? Or is it, you know, customer data, right? So all of that, you know, insurance perspective from, you know, the how do you respond to an incident publicly? All of that will come into play to, you know, spit out a dollar value, right, on that risk. And that should dictate, you know, how they invest into protecting a lot of those.
Would you say people are doing that at the moment?
I think it's changing. I think it's certainly, you know, better than it was 3-4 years ago. But still, we, you know, a long way to go on that. I think most mature CISOs will have a good grasp of that, and they will understand how to quantify that with the board, with CFOs, and so on. You know, the more immature ones, probably not. They're still treating it as IT, right? I need to do something because I know there's a risk, but I don't really know how much money that equates to, right? So, and then it goes back to, you know, this is a procurement exercise, right? I know I need to, you know, deploy some sort of zero trust network access. So I'll go to, you know, 5-6 different vendors. I've got 10,000 users. I'll get quotes. I'll make a decision based on price and feature, right? Rather than what are the types of users that I have and what are the problems that I'm trying to solve.
Yeah, and that absolutely makes sense. And I was even thinking about this the other day. It was obviously almost coming up to a year since, you know, large breach here in Australia. I was even thinking, like, the longevity of how to win customers back, because people are still going to be like, oh, like, you're the company that got breached. Probably not going to sign up with you. So that's even going to be really hard to quantify and qualify even from a cost point of view, because that could go on for years. Like, who knows when that could end? It could be 20 years before people go, oh, well, now I trust you again and I'm happy to buy your services again. So how do you put, like, dollar figures on that?
I'm sure there's some consultants who will be able to, you know, interview a bunch of people and understand what the time frame will look like. I've got no idea how that translates into a dollar figure.
Yeah, and that's fair enough. So you mentioned, Fernando, that people are getting too lost in the possible threats and that they're therefore overwhelmed and distracted, which makes sense, right? Because a lot of stuff going on here, people talking about different things. So maybe I'm curious to know from your point of view, can you describe what a possible threat is?
The chance of a breach versus, you know, an outage versus, you know, a bad user experience versus losing customers, right? So that there's a lot of people get lost into the what ifs rather than, you know, this is a direction that we need to go and, you know, we need to transform our network, we need to transform our systems, we need to transform how we provision access. You know, I still see a lot of people with, you know, third parties that are accessing, you know, their systems through VPNs and things like that, right? And there's better ways of doing that today that, you know, they're just like, well, but we trust them. And this is the idea of, can we get breached or is it easy for someone to breach a partner of mine and get access that way, right? And supply chain has been a problem for quite a while now, right? And we had several breaches that were related to our supply chain, both on software and you know, vendor supply chain. So it's sort of a, you know, the possibility of a vulnerability being exploited, or I'll just go and steal someone's password because they use the same password for everything and there's no MFA. Right? Is there a chance of a very advanced attacker, or anything basic will get through, right? And most times the basic will get through and people are just in their minds thinking of the possibility of, you know, a threat actor that will be, you know, a nation state or anything like that.
So would you say that people are more, and this is generally more focused on advanced rather than basic stuff? Is that what you're sort of saying here?
Yeah. The amount of organizations that still don't, you know, enforce MFA to every single employee is huge, right? The amount of people that still expose, you know, remote desktop servers, as I mentioned before, you know, cloud environments and so on, for even if they did it for a day or two, it's still up. I know we are a large organization here in Australia. They did a test to see how long it would take for one of their remote desktop servers to get breached. They spun one up on a brand new instance in or tenancy in AWS, and it took them 17 minutes, right, for that to get exploited. So, you know, and sometimes just the basics of, you know, just don't do it, right? Because the risk is there. Don't, you know, spin up a server and go out for lunch, you know, and leave that open. And, I'll apply the security patches later, you know. It's just that the very basics are still not being done, right?
So I'm curious to know, why would people, generally speaking, be more focused on advanced stuff than basic stuff? Like, why?
Because that's what makes the news, right? That's why, you know, people are always talking, like when the Optus breach first came out, right, with the Optus CEO saying, you know, it was an advanced attack, right? And it wasn't. It was just an insecure API. So, you know, the words, you know, advanced and looking into, you know, North Korea and China and, you know, something that's like, oh my God, that's, you know, the sort of stuff that you see in the movies is what people get, or, you know, a hacker will get into it. And, you know, look at the amount of people that have their Instagram accounts hacked. It's as basic as, you know, you're using password 1234. So there's a lot of, you know, basics that people haven't really been focusing on as much as they should. And they're looking into, you know, large cybersecurity programs within organizations, and they want to spend, you know, millions of dollars to buy, you know, the latest and greatest. And in reality, they could solve, you know, the bulk of their problems without spending any money.
So you're even saying that an internal CISO potentially is very focused on advanced stuff when they should be doing basic stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm curious to know, like, if your role as a CISO is to protect your company and serve your business, and I get that, but why would they then be focused on these arbitrary possible threats than the basic stuff? I get from a media point of view, I get that they're going to want to talk about something and they're going to rile things up and say things that don't make sense. I get that. But then if I'm internal CISO, why would I think like that?
I don't think it's intentional, right? It's not on purpose either. I think, you know, the biggest problem is that, you know, you have, you know, a bunch of developers that are, you know, cowboys that will spin up instances everywhere. And, you know, those instances will have direct connectivity back into the environment. And, you know, and sometimes it's just the not knowing what you have. Right. So it's not necessarily intentional, but, you know, they may build all the defenses with, you know, the best security products out there, and, you know, someone goes and, you know, spins up an instance somewhere that doesn't have any security associated with it, and, you know, they end up losing millions of records.
Yeah, and I think I was in an interview last year with someone who used that very same example. The only reason they knew that someone spun up something was because of the credit card statement. They had no idea about it because they obviously had paid for it, and that's the only reason why they knew about it.
Yeah.
That seems real basic. Now we're actually going back through credit card statements to find out what we have. Are you surprised by that?
No, not one bit. And again, right, like if you look into, you know, the way organizations move from a development perspective, and again, right, like I think the traditional IT, as it has been for, you know, 20, 30 years, has damaged the way we think from prevents us from thinking in a more modern way, right? So if you look into how developers work, they spin up things and spin down and, you know, and create new environments and blow them away. And it's forever changing, right? There's a lot of assets that don't even live for longer than a day. And IT has always been, you know, that concept of, you know, servers, networks, devices, right? So physical things that got virtualized over the years. And we're still looking to, you know, data centers. And then cloud or infrastructure as a service became an extension of a data center or a replacement of a data center. And that IT mentality doesn't really line up with the speed that developers need to move. So you end up giving access to developers to be able to spin up instances and things like that. But you have to rely on them adding the right security controls as well. And I think there's a big problem with education. There's a big problem with, you know, giving the right tools that will have security built in versus, you know, relying on them putting security in place, right? And this is, you know, it may sound basic, but it happens a lot, right? With people spinning up, you know, Azure instances and, you know, AWS instances and so on, right? And there's been plenty of examples of breaches where, you know, attackers managed to get into a domain controller, managed to breach into the Azure tenancy, spin up a virtual machine and open that to the outside world. So that was the way back in, right? Through remote desktop. And the organization didn't even know that was an open instance.
I'm curious then to know, just from your point of view, what should people be focused on?
Look, I think the, you know, going back to basics, right? Like I think there's a lot of things that we don't do today from both our, you know, personal devices as well as corporate. From a corporate perspective, there's, you know, like I was telling my whole family that, you know, I pay for one password for all of them, right? And my dad is the only one who uses it. You know, and even him, he's got a bunch of passwords that are the same, but he just uses that to store the login and just to make the login faster, right? But so that sort of, you know, not reusing passwords on any accounts, making sure that, you know, you turn on MFA for everything. For organizations, I think that there should be enforced MFA. Organizations should be able to allow developers to build on their environments with security already built in without them having to worry about that. You know, having a good grasp of being faster to patch their environments because, you know, Patch Tuesday, I used to joke a few years ago that Patch Tuesday, we used to joke about Exploit Wednesday. There's a lot of, you know, reverse engineered exploits that get created on Wednesdays. I think there was SAP did a piece of research looking into how long it took for attackers or for them to see instances of SAP being exploited in the wild after a security patch was released, and they got to a number of 72 hours, right? So if you look into, you know, an SAP environment, the SAP releases a new patch bundle, how long would an organization take to patch that, right? Certainly longer than 72 hours, right? So we need to sort of either add, you know, compensating controls in place or, you know, hiding those instances from the internet or, you know, however people do that. But we just need to stop doing the traditional, you know, I rely on my firewalls and I rely on boxes and things like that, right? Right, certainly longer than 72 hours, right? So we need to sort of either add, you know, compensating controls in place or, you know, hiding those instances from the internet or, you know, however people do that. But we just need to stop doing the traditional, you know, I rely on my firewalls and I rely on boxes and things like that, right?
Thanks for tuning in. For more industry-leading news and thought-provoking articles, visit kbi.media to get access today.
This is KBCast, the voice of cyber.